Caller says water has been out in the Clonlea Park in Lifford for a number of days, with workers on the street who do not seem to be able to say when it will be back on. I'm not sure they're able to offer that information, but we'll try and find out if we can get any further information. Right, okay. Experts from RCSI, University of Medicine and Health Sciences, have warned about the serious health risks associated with vaping, saying that it may be another decade before we see the real impact of the younger population that are now vaping. Professor Donal F. O'Shea is Professor and Head of Department of Chemistry at RCSI, the Royal College of Surgeons, Ireland, and he's with us now. Good morning to you, Donal. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Greg, for having me on your show.
Yeah, the big gap in our knowledge here really has been time, hasn't it? I mean, you know, in the early days of smoking, I'm sure no one was presenting with respiratory illnesses straight away, lung cancer, heart disease, and what have you. Vaping is relatively new. You would imagine that it has to be doing something to you, and it seems now, thanks to AI, which is bridging that time gap, really, I suppose, to some extent, we are learning something, or we think we are. Tell us about that, Professor.
Yeah, you're right. So historically, we know that it took 30 years of scientists and doctors to convince politicians and the public that tobacco smoke was going to cause cancers, and it duly did. And what we're trying to do is not to have to go through that cycle again and use something like artificial intelligence to give us that insight. And what we've been looking at are specifically the flavor chemicals that are in these vapes. There's about 180 different chemicals being used in the vapes that are sold in Ireland today. And what happens to them just before you inhale them? So they're heated to a high temperature. And what we can simulate through the AI is that they're being broken down into a whole cocktail of new chemicals, which have significant health impact, we would believe. Over long term, yeah, you're right, it won't be today or tomorrow. It's going to be an accumulation of damage in the younger generation starting from now. And really, we've only seen that upsurge in the younger generation in the past year, 2 years, really, is where it's really taken off in Ireland. And it's seen in every city and town around Ireland, where you see it in schools and the vape shops and so on.
So in terms of the ingredients, on paper, everything looks fine, does it? You know, these are derived from food industry. They're used in food. Right. People consume them. They're not seeing as being a problem. The gap there is as though they weren't designed or tested, heated to very, very high temperatures, and what reaction there might be in a space where they were never designed to be used.
You're right, yes. So they have an excellent safety profile in our foods for years, in sweets and drinks and pastries and so on. And we can tolerate those, obviously, we eat them. But this is a completely different approach for using them that has never been tested before. Essentially heating them to a high temperature and instantly inhaling them into your lungs. So it's a complete different kettle of fish, essentially not being tested for this at all prior to this. So really, unfortunately, there's so much unknown. But what we know from a scientific point of view, that if you inhale chemicals like this into your lungs for long periods of time, diseases will emerge. It's almost a certainty. It's just shouldn't be going into our lungs. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out, to be perfectly honest. So what we're just trying to show in a big picture, all the different flavors that are currently being sold in Ireland, what's happening to them before you inhale them into your lungs. And from there, because we know what those chemicals now are, we can see what their toxicities are, what their health hazards are. And from there, you can begin to see what diseases are going to emerge.
All right, I have a couple of questions, but just to clear up as much as is possible, if at all, the flavor side of things. You know, I mean, obviously, people form nicotine addictions and they're very, very difficult to shake, no doubt about that. And I want to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But how do you differentiate between ones that are flavoured or not flavoured? Like, are there non-flavoured vape juices on the market? Or they all contain a flavour of some sort or other?
Originally, when vapes first emerged in the mid-2000s, they were not flavoured at all. And it was marketed as a way for people to quit tobacco smoking with very few chemicals in there, only nicotine and a couple of carrier chemicals. But that's not the way it is anymore. Now it is all about the flavors. So even if you could buy those, which may or may not be still in shops, they're not the ones that our teenagers are interested in. They're all attracted by the flavors and the varying flavors and the huge diversity of flavors.
Yeah, and there's been different views. You know, I think the HSC never really wanted to sort of endorse vaping as a smoking cessation situation. I think the Royal College of Surgeons did suggest that, you know, there are great benefits here, and for the data that was available at that time, significantly less harmful than smoking. And putting that to one side for a moment, the conversation is completely different now, because we have hundreds of thousands of a new generation and new generations now that have become very reliant on these items. They're flavored. Now, how we even start to wean people off nicotine, I don't even know how that's going to happen, right? Because I know myself, it's an absolute bloody nightmare. So even putting that, that's going to be a big issue, getting people heavily addicted to nicotine. Some of these are 18, 24 grams of nicotine. Massive amounts. Yeah. So it's, even if we start talking about the flavors, getting rid of the flavors, we've got so many people with an addict that have never ever smoked that are addicted to this incredibly addictive substance, Donal.
Yeah, so what we are, you're right on those points. So what were initially what you're looking at as an attempt to solve an older generation addicted to tobacco smoking and the nicotine in it. And essentially what we're in the process of doing is transferring this nicotine addiction, even in a more addictive manner, through vaping, to the younger generation that have never smoked. So our progress nationally to get our smoking levels down is going into reverse in the form of vaping. And you cannot overstate how difficult the nicotine addiction is. So it is very, very hard to break, and people need a lot of not just devices or replacement nicotine approaches, if it's patches or gums, they need counseling. It's not simply just give somebody a nice flavored vape and it will solve the problem. If it did, who would complain? Mm. But we know that's just not going to work. And what's beginning to emerge now is you see people stuck with both curses, vaping and tobacco smoke, because it's not a way to sustain off tobacco smoking.
The problem is if vapes become unavailable, say they were banned today, the amount of new smokers that would be enormous. I don't even know how you would, because they would have to get nicotine.
In terms of those who are currently addicted to nicotine, yes.
Yeah.
But I think what we've seen in the younger population is that tobacco smoking is not cool, it is not popular, and it smells, and it's just not a young person thing. Mm. We have unfortunately provided an alternative. So what we're arguing is that if we take the flavors out of the vapes, I don't think a total ban of anything works in any society, to be perfectly honest, in my own personal opinion. But if we take the flavors out, first of all, at least then the attraction to the underage teenagers or young adults would be gone. And no doubt about it, the people who are already addicted to vaping are going to need support. Mm-hmm. This is a really difficult addiction to break. And the people who sell these know this.
And well, listen, it's no surprise that really quite early on, the tobacco industry started investing heavily in the vape industry because they knew they had to edge their bets because of what was coming down the line. Professor, we are, as dire as it might sound, we are at a huge advantage now. We talked earlier on about smoking, the early days of smoking, the fight to sort of recognize its damaging nature and all that kind of stuff. We've actually been able to fast forward an awful lot with vaping using AI, using logic and common sense as well, of course.
Yeah.
So the likes of yourself, the RCSI colleagues and what have you, are saying very clear to government, it's almost inevitable that particularly flavored vapes are going to cause lung issues, respiratory issues, even they're carcinogenic, right? Now, it's up to the legislators to take this early warning, isn't it? Because we are talking billions upon billions of euro. If you don't want to worry about the human life, we're talking about billions upon billions of euro coming down the line that's going to be on the health service to deal with the potential outcomes here.
I agree, yes. I think now is the time to act. Like our politicians over 20 years ago led the way about banning indoor tobacco smoking and At the time, I'm sure there were people ridiculing Ireland for trying to do this, and it's been a tremendous success. So yes, there is always an inertia to try to get that legislation in place, but we see internationally other countries changing their minds as well. They see the problem and they see the health implications for their younger population in the future. And as I say, even if it's only on a cost basis, you think about it, it makes perfect sense to try to tackle this now, which is what we're trying to sort of indicate in terms of our AI approach, rather than waiting for 15 years time and then have to do it.
In other words, we can make this generation the last generation to become addicted to flavored vapes and run these risks.
Exactly. I think that's what our government's goal should be.
Okay, well, we shall see if it's heeded. Huge lobbying on behalf of the vape and tobacco industry is to offset the type of thing you're saying. But anyway, sure. That is life, unfortunately. Professor Donal F. O'Shea, thank you so very much for your time today. As I say, for those of you not comfortable listening, just want to be able to get on with life and have a vape, but that's what the Royal College of Surgeons Ireland is saying. Okay, by the way, the road between Chrysler at the log cabin is now cleared, by the way, just in case it affects your journey on the roads today. It was blocked briefly, it seems, because of a collision, but it's clear now again. So, Greg, I think it would be more important to give support of all kinds, including financial, to the likes of Rose instead of giving €100,000 to the CEO of the organisation. I can't argue it one way or other. All I could do really is sort of outline the argument that's made in favour of the salaries to Pieta. It's not really for me to say it's right or wrong. There's a dip on at Port na Blah Pier at 4 a.m. on Monday morning. Sorry, what did I say Monday for? On Saturday morning. There's a dip at Port na Blah Pier at 4 a.m. on Monday morning, the 11th of May, for darkness into light. Thanks for sharing. My pleasure. Well, that would certainly warm the cockles. Well, I was going to say warm the cockles. Wouldn't warm them. It would clear the cobwebs, though. There's a very well-known councillor who manages a hotel and is president of a national sporting organisation. Also has two farms. How does he find the time to do all of these jobs properly? I think that's easily identified there as Councillor Micheál Nocton. I'm sure he would argue that he is flat out doing stuff and just manages his time well. Morning, Greg. Could you please ask your listeners if they're having problems with the Vodafone coverage in the Carrigans area? Thanks. Is it data? Is it calls? Is it absolutely everything? I'm not quite sure, but it's out there now. Hi, Greg. Sand covered my windscreen along the River Foyle at 8 a.m. as I was driving. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much for that. Yep, a few reports earlier on of sandstorms. Look, it's Sahara sand. It's how it gets up here. We don't know. Greg had a sand shower in Letterkenny also. Car covered in it. It's Sahara desert sand. Okay, brilliant. Did anyone else watch Alan Shatter on The Tonight Show last night? Thought his views on Gaza were disgraceful. I didn't see it. I think he was up against... Oh, it's an English journalist. I can't remember his name. I heard he had it handed to him. I didn't see it myself. Hi, Greg. I had sand on my car yesterday morning in the Remelton area. There'll be a community clean-up in Annagree this evening at 5 p.m. Bags and gloves will be available at the hall. You've hi-vis tops or pickers, please bring them along. Your help would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. And a big shout-out to the people who do amazing work keeping our towns and villages clean and tidy. I won't embarrass anyone, but... in some of them, the mess left in the morning is absolutely horrendous. And I pass through a town and there's a gentleman out with his picker in his bag. And pretty much every morning you will see him. And he cleans up this particular town or village. And by the time then people get up for their regular start times, everything looks fantastic. And he's picking up other stuff that people are just chucking. So a big shout out to people like that gentleman who have the place looking spick and span on their own time. Wake up. Yeah, okay. Right. My daughter came home from school yesterday and asked me if she could watch Baby Reindeer as all her friends are watching it and she feels left out. She is, wait for it, 11. I was outraged. The show was a tough watch for adults, never mind vulnerable children. It got me thinking about, should we put more trigger warnings on programs like these and keep an eye on our children? I told her that it was a very inappropriate show for children. Her answer was, well, my friends are watching it. She was even able to tell me that the real Martha was doing an interview. Yeah, she's on with Piers Morgan today. Our children are so in touch with social media, we need to be careful. It's a toughie, right? Because I suppose if you don't know baby reindeer, your kid probably has, your child probably has access to Netflix and they're watching it. I don't think parents are going, yeah, I've watched it. You watch it now. It'll be grand. I think there's an element of maybe our ignorance as parents and guardians. It is not for 11-year-olds. I think the, some of the subject matter could really be troublesome for someone that age. There are trigger warnings on the show, particularly for one episode. I think it's episode 4. There is a, not a trigger warning as such, but there's a warning of the content that is to follow. I would not be comfortable with an 11-year-old watching it. All parents are different, of course. But I think we need to make sure we know what our children are watching as well. And I would say some of your children's friends' parents maybe don't realise it. Baby Reindeer, does it sound like a show that's perhaps for a broader audience? I don't know. Okay, let's take a break. We have Professor Joe, or Dr. Joe, on the way. All right, we all like a bit of intrigue and mystery, don't we? Well, you don't have to travel too far for it sometimes. Maybe you have to travel a bit in time, but certainly not geographically. On the 8th of July, 1933, Arthur Kingsley, a porter, a Harvard University professor, mysteriously disappeared on Inishbofin Island here in Donegal. His body was never recovered. He came from a wealthy Connecticut family, was a distinguished archaeologist and scholar, and he bought Glenveagh Castle in 1929, as well as owning a simple fisherman's cottage on Inishbofin Island. So today, we're going to talk history with Dr. Joe Kelly about this gentleman and the circumstances surrounding his mysterious death and disappearance. Good morning to you, Dr. Joe Kelly. How are you keeping? Majin why,
Greg, is the Loch Déistíochtaí, and hope everybody's enjoying the better weather that we've been having in the last while.
Right, okay. This is Historical Intrigue and Mystery 101. So what do we know about Arthur Kingsley?
Well, Arthur Kingsley Porter was born in 1883, so that'll place it in its context, you know, coming to towards the end of Victorian times. But he was born in Connecticut along what they call the Gold Coast. So his family, his dad was a banker, a very wealthy man, and his mother in her own right was also a very wealthy woman. So he came from a very, very wealthy, well-heeled background. But the, apart from the fact that they were very wealthy, they were very, you know, interested in education. An erudite family who really supported their children and encouraged them to get as educated as they possibly could. And there's a lot of correspondences that survive still within the family of the letters that the mum and father were writing to their children while they were at college, clearly showing their interest in their educational development. So he obviously had a very excellent academic prowess and understanding and developed those skills and became, you know, later on he'd become a Harvard professor. But that was all rooted in his family. But things would change. As I said, he was born in 1883, but things would change in the 90s. In 1891, when he was only 8 years old, his mother died. She got pneumonia. And then some years later, then his father, Timothy, was paralyzed. Mm. So right away, the two most significant people in his life, you know, had been either died or is ill. And what led to a wee bit of difficulties then was that Kingsley's father started dating his Kingsley's former governess, the woman in the house that was looking after him as a young boy. And this led to lawsuits because she was trying to claim some of their inheritance.
And how wealthy were the, you know, what was up for grabs? How wealthy were the Porters?
Oh, you're talking millions and millions. Mm. It's and that time. So when you try to put millions and millions, okay, say in the 1890s into the present context, they were extremely wealthy.
So was the dad still incapacitated as his partner then tried to, I suppose, secure her share of the fortune before he succumbed?
Yes, I think that was the idea. And it was at that time as well, see, the other brother died in 1895. So this is all nearly one, two, three things happening. He was only 18 years old. And so he obviously felt very much alone in this. Now, he had another brother still alive. But eventually the court favoured the Porters when they took the whole case to the courts, the American courts. They went with Porter. So that meant that he stood to become a very, very wealthy young man when he was 18. And what she did, she became a multi-millionaire.
So he would never have had to have worked a day in his life effectively, but perhaps, I don't know, through his own motivation or through encouragement from his family. What was his education then?
Well, he was interested, he had a BA and he was interested in archaeology. That was his field and the arts of archaeology. And that's what he had studied. And he actually wrote, published a book. He graduated in 1906 and he published a book on medieval architecture. It was over 1,000 pages long, so it took two volumes. So obviously he had come to a certain competence and a certain skill, which was probably beyond the average student graduating with a BA. But as I said, you know, when he was 18, he stood to start to gain a lot of money, which he did. And so in 1902, both he and his brother decided to go on a 73-day world cruise.
Oh, wow.
Very nice. And they explored, you know, traveling the world to explore other cultures. And he was drawn particularly to Normandy in France. And again, that was the architectural buildings and the stone and things like that there. So he also visited Italy and traveled a terrible lot, Italy, France. And took one of the things that he did, which proved later on to be very, very significant, he took photographs. He could afford to take photographs, and he took thousands and thousands of photographs of stone buildings, of cathedrals and churches, and particularly the statues and the sculptures of seraphim or lions or whatever. And he took thousands and thousands of photographs, and they're all archived and still held in Harvard.
I imagine that would have been a very interesting connection in that times, because he, A, had the resources to travel great distances, also the resources, obviously, to photograph. There wouldn't have been many walking the planet at that stage that would have had that ability to sort of gather up so much stuff from so many different places.
Yeah, and had the finance to stay and study and move from building to building. Yeah, and later on, I'm going to talk about maybe after World War One, the French government and the Italian government asked him to come back and to do an inventory and to find out how some of these monuments could be restored to their former glory. Mm. So he was very, very significant in that sense because of his experience, something very maybe unusual that he had done before the war. And after the war, they went looking for him to help them out, to help the French. And they honoured him for that as well. He got certain titles and he worked with the French and the Italians. But about 1911, he met this girl called Lucy Bryant. She was about 35 and he was about 28. And they had a mutual love for the arts and the architecture and things like that there. And she was very good at organizing. She was very practical, a woman. Mm. And so they married in 1912. And she was like a soulmate to him. And she now continued to travel with him. And she took more of the photographs and he did more of the research. And like, he published numerous books, upwards of 50 different archaeological books. He was a real, real scholar.
Are they well received in this day and age, Joe? Because obviously he had the resources to do them. You also need the skills so you can publish stuff, right? If you have the resources to do so. It doesn't mean that necessarily are well-received or are seen as important books. How does history reflect on Arthur Kingsley Porter's work in terms of publications?
Well, he was asked to be assistant professor of art and culture in Yale University in 1917. His publications were of such a standard that it drew world universities look at the work he was doing. Very specific, but very understood, very much to be very important. And in fact, when you asked me how wealthy he was willing to give Yale $500,000 of an endowment. And also the collection of paintings that he had were very, very valuable. And they turned him down. Now, he was a lecturer in Yale at the time. Mm. They didn't accept it. And I think that soured him a little bit. And it was later on then he was offered a professorship in Harvard. And that was the beginning then of his connection with Harvard, another famous American.
And was his lecturing or his role as a professor in tandem with his travel, or are they two separate parts of his life?
Very good. You're correct. See, what happened was he took on the professorship in Harvard on one condition, that he could continue to travel and that if his travels extended into the academic term, that they would allow for that. So that's what he started to do. He would travel to Italy, travel to France, and then come back when it suited him, and then he'd go and give his lectures. But he bought a house, which is still there in Harvard, and he entertained people and students and professors and lecturers, and he seemed to have been very much liked. And he really enjoyed his lecturing, but it gave him the freedom as well to do the things that he wanted to do.
But the timeline has us... The timeline has us, though, running into World War One, though. So what did that mean for his life, particularly, I suppose, in terms of travelling? I don't know, during the World Wars, you wouldn't by choice presumably head to a war zone as such. What impact did that have on him, I wonder?
Yeah, that's a very good question. He couldn't travel to Europe during the wars, that's correct. And so therefore that made him focus a little bit more on his Harvard professorship. But as I said, after the war then, they invited him back, which drew him more away from Harvard, and he continued to spend more time in Europe. So you're coming into the mid-20s. And it's interesting that when he was looking at all the architecture of ancient medieval times, that he claimed that the Irish manuscripts had influenced the design of some of these sculptures and some of these, which is very interesting. You wonder how it came from Irish manuscripts out into medieval Europe, but this was his theory. And he took an interest then about, you know, you're talking about the 1920s, and he started taking interest in Ireland and in the High Crosses. And so he arrived here for the first time in Ireland in 1927, around, or 27, 28. Sorry, in 1928, it was his first time coming here. And he took a house in Meath, and he went to see Tara and the Leofile, the Stone of Destiny, and Kells and Durrow. And he started to get terrible big interest in Columbkille. Columbkille seemed to have attracted his soul, not just his mind, but his soul. There was something about this man that he just found amazing. And so he went to Iona, and then obviously he came to Donegal and Sir Columbkille and Gartan. And, you know, when he was here then, he found out about Glenveagh Castle being available. Now, he came to Marble Hill and he stayed there for a while first.
Was he working during his time here? Like, up until his initial arrival in Ireland and his interest in the High Crosses, his development in the interest of Columbkille, and then, of course, then coming to Donegal, and then we'll go straight on to Glenveagh. Like, what period of time, how long are we talking there? I presume, 5 or 6 years? And is he working? Is he holidaying? Is he semi-moved here? Or is he back and forth?
Well, he's in Europe in June 25, and it seems to be June 25, and it seems to be at that stage that he starts taking an interest in Ireland. And he writes to this man in Ireland, Thomas Mason, who was a photographer, "Would you mind photographing some of the Irish High Crosses and some of the Irish materials that are available from that period in the National Archives or whatever is available?" And so he was sending him pictures. And so by that kind of given preparatory work, when he arrived here in 1928, he knew what he wanted to see. And then he would write a book on the Irish High Crosses, a copy of it. So he talked about the Irish High Crosses. So this drew him right into the heart and soul of Ireland. And it seemed that, you know, you're talking about the late 20s, he seems to have fallen in love with the place. Mm-hmm. He found something here, and particularly in Donegal, that his soul was at peace to.
Well, here. He knew Glenveagh Castle was on the market. He had an interest in it. We'll find out if he bought it and what happened next. Next, after this quick break. So we are talking history with Dr. Joe Kelly, historian and author, and our focus today is on Arthur Kingsley Porter. He was a Harvard University professor and mysteriously disappeared on Inishbofin Island here in County Donegal. His body was never discovered. That was in 1933. We are in the late 20s now, and Glenveagh Castle is on the market. We know that Arthur Kingsley Porter, has the resources. He bought it. What was his intentions, Joe?
Well, that's very interesting, your question. What was his intentions? Obviously, as I'd said earlier there, he had taken an interest in Irish culture and heritage in Columbkille. He was a man that enjoyed learning, and he enjoyed being able to have parties, and Glenveagh allowed him to entertain people. So it was of a status that would be equal to his own wealth. And there was something unique about that for him. So you're talking the late 20s, and the Cordelia Adair died in 1921, so the castle was for sale, and he bought it for £5,000, and so decided to make his, you know, home or a holiday home there, and start coming there more often from Harvard. But at this stage, and you'll be finding some of his letters to one of his brother. Saying that he was suffering from depression.
And you talked of his marriage in 1911 to Lucy Wallace, but he then realised or struggled or was torn because he was gay. Was that happening during this timeline? Is this contributing? Yeah. We're talking about a very different time. Is this contributing to his poor mental health, I wonder?
I think so. I think so. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. It was at this time, and it's clear from some of his personal writings, that he was felt very dislocated and wasn't able to, you know, face maybe things in life because of depression coming from the realization that he was gay. And
would it have affected his position in Harvard or his standing in society, I suppose?
You know, when we look at the history and maybe from gay people's point of view, it was maybe, you know, the 1920s and 1930s were a very, even right up until the 1990s, it was a very, very unforgiving environment. And unfortunately, you know, you had the whole Puritan idea. And in Harvard University, there was eight students were expelled because of gayness. And one professor had been sacked, assistant professor had been sacked. And then another student seemingly committed suicide. And it looked like the professor there, the head man there, that the president, Abbott Lowell, he was on a witch hunt. And there was a series of night meetings held with Kingsley, and where they were kind of more or less interrogating him. And I'm sure this affected his whole soul. Now, he had exposed his soul to his wife, Lucy, and told him, look, I think I'm gay. And he got in touch with a man in England. He was kind of a leading expert in sexuality, particularly with gays, Dr. Ellis, who had written and co-authored a book called Sexual Inversion in 1896. And it was only in the 80s we found out more about this connection with Ellis and Kingsley when letters were found by the grandson, Ellis's letters from Kingsley, and him opening up his soul, saying, you know, how he was feeling. And so to help, and he discussed this with his wife, and she seemed to have been very supportive of Kingsley exploring his sexuality, hoping that it, you know, that he would be made whole again, so to speak, and feel better.
She might have thought it was a phase or something, who's to say?
But Ellis suggested that he would have a boyfriend, and his name was a young man called Alan Campbell, who came to Glenveagh and stayed with him for a couple of months. And Kingsley seemed, you know, his mood seemed to have changed. He writes, you know, that this month, which has been one of the happiest for me, you know, so he obviously, and he was having a physical relationship. You wonder how Lucy was coping with that. But she was
also in Glenveagh at that time?
In Glenveagh at that time as well. So it must have been very difficult for her. But
and was it a scandal, or I don't know his position in terms of social circles, or?
It wouldn't have been known. Only Lucy.
But how did Harvard find out? Did he divulge that information, or was it on the grapevine, or?
Maybe they just were trying to interpret that he might be, because of his, maybe just the way he had Alan, the young Alan Campbell that stayed with him then, they also returned to America to become his secretary, and that raised questions. But so he comes back to Ireland a number of times, and he's trying to figure out his own sexuality and trying to come to terms with it. And it kind of comes to a high point. In 1933, they returned to Ireland. And he found out that the college would back him, that they weren't going to sacrifice him to the desires of the president, who was just on a witch hunt because he was gay. And so he felt probably a little bit of relief from that. And so they came to Glenveagh, and they had a house in East Boffin. They'd built a little, and still there. And Mark McMenamin, a great historian, has done a doc on one, The Lost Millionaire, and he went out to East Boffin. I helped him during the research. He's done a lot of Lost Millionaire, if anybody's interested in it. And the house is still there. So Kingsley would come there. No running water, very basic. This was a millionaire.
How modest is the house, Joe? You've been there, of course.
It's only Crathla, it's only a ruins now.
So what was his connection to the island? Why? Or was there any particular connection? Or did he just fancy the solitude?
I think it was the solitude. And he paid the people of the island £2 a year each for him to use the beach privately. Himself, he and his wife would go there and he would write. And some believe that he wrote the famous book on Columbkiller. A drama on Columbkiller, one of the on an East Boffin island.
So it could have been a writing retreat as much as anything.
And it was a place for him probably where he had a great freedom, and that he, you know, that he could be himself and not have to take in the cares of the world and get away from everything.
Okay.
Probably as well, you know, because he was so wealthy and such, that he probably had to filter out who was really there for him and who wasn't.
Okay, yeah. So, of course, when you're well-resourced as well and what have you. So we're getting now to the crux of the mystery, because he disappeared on the 8th of July. What do we know about the hours or days leading up to the 8th of July and his actual disappearance?
Well, we know some stuff. It's not all very clear, and this is the mystery that you talked about at the beginning. But both he and his wife, Lucy, were heading to Inishbofinne on the 7th, and A.E., who Russell, a famous scholar and writer, a friend of theirs, was coming to visit them in Glenveagh on the
8th. Where was Campbell?
Campbell at this stage wasn't there. He'd gone back to America, but
okay.
There was still some form of relationship there, but he'd gone back, and he was to return back to Glenveagh, and Campbell would go to France and tour different places as well, Alan Campbell. But they decided to go to Inishbofinne just for an overnight, and when they went there, Kingsley had his own boat. He called it the Swan, and it's the last picture of Kingsley standing with his trousers rolled up to his knees in the water with his boat out in front of him, getting ready to go into the boat. And he rowed out. And Owen McGee, the local man from Inishbofinne, had Lucy, Kingsley's wife, in his boat. And so he rowed out. He was obviously a physically strong, capable man. And he loved rowing. And he called it the Swan, which is very interesting because he was gifted swan eggs in Glenveagh, and it's one of the things in Irish mythology and folklore that you never touch swans or their eggs. And if you do, you bring death to your door. That would be an old pishrog or old belief. But he called the boat the Swan, and it's very interesting that the next day he had disappeared. But he went out to the island and spent the night there, himself and his wife. And in the morning, about 10 o'clock, Kingsley says, look, I'll walk round one way around the island to come back, and I'll meet you at the pier in Maharoa or at Inishbofinne. And so when she arrived there was no Kingsley, and she mm-hmm. went back to look for him, and he wasn't there. There was no Kingsley, and to this day there's no Kingsley. So what happened, nobody knows. So there's possible that he took a turn while walking and maybe a heart attack or something and fell into the sea. Was it suicide? And then there's other theories, was that there was a boat waiting for him that took him out of the island so that he could disappear and live his gay life in another world, in another place, in other countries. So they're the three theories.
What seems the most logical to you?
Sadly, I think it's possibly suicide due to the fact that he was gay. I think that coming to terms with his sexuality created such a difficulty, and in an environment that was very hostile, that's my own thinking. Mm. I could be wrong.
There doesn't seem a great deal of logic to disappearing to live his life as a gay man elsewhere. I mean, that contradicts everything up until this point in his life, seemingly.
Well, interesting that some people later on supposedly spotted him in Paris in a hotel there, yeah. And local people. So there's those stories. And then what was very, very interesting is Dr. McGinley, J.P. McGinley, who was the coroner at the inquest on the 12th of September in Godahark, 1933, Lucy said, you know, our married life was happy one, and Mr. Porter had no troubles, financial or otherwise. Well, that's not 100% accurate or true, because we know that he was struggling with his sexuality. And we know too, in 1929, that there was a Wall Street crash, which would have affected him financially.
Yeah.
He still had millions, but he still had been...
his wealth would be directly linked to that, his actual worth. So what was the determination of any inquest or investigation into his death?
Well,
what did it conclude?
They presumed that he had fallen into the sea. They didn't say why.
And you know the topography of the island. Does that seem likely to you?
It doesn't look for me. I mean, there's supposedly the cliffs and all, there's not really the cliffs along where his house was. It slopes gently enough into the sea. In fact, it'd be nearly impossible unless you're
to run and jump to actually clear any ledges and what have you.
Did he fall in naturally? What I'm saying is by accident.
Yes, I understand.
It doesn't add up for me. But look, other people are of different opinions. And what is very interesting is that the death cert that was issued was the first time in Ireland that an inquest certified a death without a corpse. So now Lucy could go back to America and claim his estate.
Mm.
And so this is why people would be saying she was able to fund him then to live his life in another, you know, if that was necessary in another country. Another, but again, I don't think that's, you know, is something I would agree with. And in 1933, then she put some money towards scientific fellowship, which I thought was an amazing offer to do. So yeah. To do two things: to help homosexuals understand their own homosexuality, what that was, and she wanted research done on that. And secondly, to help society understand homosexuality. So, I mean, I thought that was very insightful from her to spend money on that and try to progress the whole understanding of what it was that her husband was suffering. And
she seems to have suffered a great deal, though, and had been very accepting. Firstly, in supporting him, I suppose, through his career, but also then with his own struggles. And for those watching the show, we can sort of see an image now of Lucy and... Lucy, you swear I knew her. We could see an image now of Lucy and Arthur. But she seems to have been a very supportive person.
Yeah. Well, look at the time. She died in 1962. So you can imagine what it was like living at that time. And obviously she was a woman that had compassion and understanding. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for her trying to square that circle. And I don't know how I would have squared that circle if it was me that was in her shoes. But the point is that she did. And she was, seemed to have been very, very, you know, advanced in her understanding. And after his death, she even published some of his books, like the Columkiller book. It wasn't published in 1952. And I just wonder, when he was writing the Columkiller book, if you would just indulge me, there was a few verses that struck me. See, Columkiller was exiled to Iona. And it kind of influenced Kingsley. And I'm just wondering, Columkiller and his coracle there on the at the shore, coracle's aboard. Columkiller and his coracle there at the shore will carry him soon, where he'll be seen no more. He'll be gone at the morrow's dawn. We'll find him wandering lonely and lorn. And then towards the end, and the boat will spread its wings of white and grow smaller and smaller at the drop and drop from sight. And those who stand on Erin's land will weep and wait and wave their hands. And in the last verse, the tides will rise and the tides will slack, but Columkiller will never come back. As rivers flow, the ages will go, and many a boat must sail just so. Was he talking about himself? Was he going to be on a boat to sail himself like Columkiller? Okay. That's the mystery.
Perhaps. And you talked of his treatment because he was gay. And history is full of examples of people, influential yeah. people who were punished because of their sexuality and rights that are there now. And in fact, to some extent, there's almost a pushback on those rights. They were hard won.
Yeah, well, again, I like your statement there. There's a pushback. And I feel, and we've talked before this, I think that the transgender thing is affecting the gay community in a negative way.
There's a new organisation that is LGB. I've spoken to people often on the record who are of the view that they would be of the view, they have different views on transgenderism and also too that they feel that the association, that it's a very different thing and that it is dragging back their hard-won rights as well. So, you know, I think the conversation that's happening in relation to transgenderism is not exclusive to heterosexuals, so to speak. There are many within the gay community too that have their feelings one way and other.
Well, I think you're making the point about historically, and like Roger Casement, one of my own heroes that came to my own parish to learn Irish, and we maybe talk about him another time. Like, he was a gay man and you know, died for Ireland, a great, great man. I wonder, you know, would have what happened, Alan Turning, who arguably, and I would argue, possibly was single-handedly brought Nazism to its knees and won the war for England. He was the co- remember the Enigma machine? I think there was a film done on it.
Cumberbatch. Yeah, he started. Good film, that is, by the way, if you haven't seen it. It wasn't pushed too heavily, but it's actually quite an interesting film.
But he figured out the Enigma, the code. He was a gay man, and he won the war for England and for the Allies, breaking this code, a really bright, intelligent man. And then he was tried some years later in the 1950s for convicted of having a relationship with a man, and he was just abandoned. And what they gave him was either you go to jail or you have chemical castration. That was the two choices that he faced. And he committed suicide in 1954 at the age of 41. horrible what happened to that man. And Gordon Brown, who was the Prime Minister in 2009, made an apology on behalf of the British government. Right, yeah. We're sorry you deserved so much better, horrifying and utterly unfair. And this country owed you a great gratitude. And the Queen then came along, I think it was about 2013, and gave him, 60 years later, and gave him a royal pardon, mm-hmm. as well as 49,000 other men that had been convicted because they were gay in that period.
Okay, Professor Joe, it's been a fascinating conversation on many levels, not least in remembering Arthur Kingsley Porter, who disappeared in mysterious circumstances. There is still debate and discussion today as to what happened to him. Did he die by suicide? His body was never found too, right? So that can't be ignored in this situation either. I'm sure there was extensive searches for that. Or did he use his resources, dwindling after the crash, to sail away? Did he write about it? Was he the column killer character that was quoted by Dr. Joe Kelly? Questions we'll never truly know the answer to, but we can enjoy speculating. Dr. Joe Kelly, Guru Mila Mahagut, thank you so very much indeed. Have a wonderful day. Talking history with Dr. Joe Kelly there. Okay, now, Paddy is in Creasla, and he says, enjoy Dr. Joe Kelly every time he's on. Would be great if all this talk, or all his talks on Highland, was easily accessible on a history podcast. It would be very popular. That comes in from Paddy in Creasla. Yes, indeed, Paddy, and it comes down to resources. I have to kind of do that stuff myself, and I did try to begin to do it, but then there's so many other things that one has to do. But leave it with me, Paddy. And I'm not sure if you heard, but you might be interested in, we did a talking history special on Creasla, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, and it was after the awful events of the Creasla explosion. And it was just really to talk about Creasla in its entirety, how it will be defined into future, who's to say, but there's such a rich history, even down to the construction of the, we talked about the Locksalt Road earlier, and it's tying in with Creasla and some interesting characters and the castle and all that kind of stuff. So yes, Paddy, noted. I would love to. If I can get the time, I will certainly work on that. But as I say, Paddy, maybe if you didn't hear it, you might be particularly interested in that chat we had on Creasla. So dry today. It'll be cloudy overall, or a good deal of cloud overall. Warm spells, though, of hazy sunshine developing. Temperatures of 16 to 20 degrees in mostly light, southerly or variable breezes. Weather looking nice for tomorrow and indeed for much of Saturday. Unfortunately, on Sunday, though, we're going to see more showers, and then into Monday and Tuesday, more showers and it turning a little bit cooler as well. But look at, we'll deal with what we have right now. Hi, Greg. Just to let you know, traffic lights between St. Johnston and Rafoe. I've been sitting here now for 10 minutes. The road seems to be blocked with a lorry. We're sitting on a bad bend. Please ask people to slow down and be careful. Now, hopefully that situation has resolved itself, but it may spring up again. Just if you're travelling in that area, be careful. Tuesday morning in Ahiarn, my car was completely white with sand. By the way, did we find the person looking for the Garden Clane, Ahiarn? Did you get that person's number? No. So if you were on to us, looking from Ahiarn specifically, looking for that clay, please get back in touch with us. I had a visit yesterday from one of the last descendants of the Friels, who very kindly called in with some of that clay for me and also for that listener. So if you're still listening, get back in touch with us. We'll try and sort it out. Okay, loads of other comments that I, well, not loads, actually, a good amount of other comments that I didn't get to on various things. Pieta House, a few people upset with the posters going up for the election. We'll get to that, I suppose, but that's where we have to leave it today. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for watching. From me, Greg Hughes, and the team of Caroline Orr, who researched and produced, and assisted by Shannon Wilkin on the programme as well.